to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. On this evening's program, the cost of innovation. Gone are the days of chalkboards and droning lectures. If you want to attract students and good professors, you have no choice but to equip your classrooms with every new high-tech gadget you can lay your hands on. Brent Pouquet of the University of Alberta School of Business looks at the complexities and costs of staying on top of the computer revolution. And the new age of ceramics. Shooting at armor plating and breaking rods are all part of a day's work for Lauren Johansson at the Alberta Research Council. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. You may as well lay down your pencils and put away that loose leaf. A trip into a state-of-the-art classroom requires neither of these. Instead, you'll plug in your laptop, check for your assignments on the professor's website, and when it comes to writing your exams, you'd better be top-notch at clicking. Of course, none of this comes cheap, as Brent Pouquet well knows. He's the Assistant Dean of Technology at the University of Alberta's School of Business.
Right now we're in one of the smart classrooms, what we've called smart classrooms here in the business building, and it looks like a traditional classroom. It has seats and chairs and a board up at the front, but no longer do we have chalk anymore. Now we've got a lot of digital technology that's permanently installed in these rooms to assist our instructors in the delivery of our course programs. So in front of us here, we've got this thing we call the instructor's station, and it's got a computer, keyboard and mouse, a control panel that controls the equipment and the lighting in the room. We've got a VCR, a sound system, wireless microphone, a patch panel that allows someone to bring in a laptop, additional network connections. So from this room, I can get access to the internet. Our staff can get access to their files over the network, and they can display information over a very high-quality projector that's mounted in the ceiling of the classroom.
Why is it necessary to go to this length to have these smart classrooms?
What we're interested in doing is providing our instructors resources that allow them to deliver programming in new and different ways. All you've got in a classroom is a piece of chalk and a board, that really limits what you can do, and this just gives our people new options. For example, if somebody was teaching a marketing class or an e-marketing class, they can actually bring up digital videos in the classroom, access websites, show students real examples of e-commerce and web portals and that sort of thing. Or on along another vein, you could have an accounting professor who's trying to describe a complex abstract theory, and they can maybe bring up an Excel spreadsheet that has a model that shows the theory in action, and it in my view, it allows our instructors to do things that improve the quality of our teaching programs here.
How much is this computer age being incorporated into the type of teaching and the type of courses that are available?
In the business school, it's used very heavily. We've made big investments in technology so that all of our classrooms are actually have this equipment installed. There are about 82 of these smart classrooms on the whole university campus, and we have about 18-19 of them right here in the business building. So you can see we've got nearly a quarter of them right here. And it's not uncommon for the equipment to be used, for the first class in the morning, all the way through to the last class of the day.
What do you do, though, when the computer crashes?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting situation because, of course, bulbs burn out and computers break down. And so we've actually got technicians who are right here on site. And when there is trouble in a classroom, the call goes into a dispatch center, and there's a technician who can be here in 5 minutes or less. And a number of times they can fix the problems.
This business building is actually a fairly new building, but it's still not new enough, is it?
That's correct. It was built in 1985, and of course, desktop computing and the internet did not really exist like they do today. And so all of the things that we've been doing here have been retrofit. So we've got large computing labs, which are tucked away in the basement of the building. It used to be a storage area. our server room and wiring center from the for the whole building used to be a storage closet on our third floor, and we've put in a whole bunch of electrical connections, air conditioning, the whole work. So it's a little bit tough, and it's a lot expensive, but it's something that we believe we need to do.
What would be some of the expense that's attached to this? Because it's certainly more than replenishing the chalk supply. But at the same time, you have to, when you just think of computers, they're constantly changing, constantly updating. How do you keep on top of it?
Sure. It's difficult. A friend of mine used to joke that the input mix for teaching programs 10 years ago was 99% instructor and 1% chalk. And today it's, of course, very different. It's, you've got an instructor. The instructor's got a web page with a whole bunch of resources for the course, and so the website has to be up all the time. We've got a classroom full of equipment, and it is a very complex and expensive environment to maintain, but we do it because we think we're improving the quality of education. When you talk about how to keep on top of the costs, there are a number of things to consider. There's the upfront investment you have to make in capital when you build these rooms. Then there's also a whole bunch of human resources that are required because, of course, the technology doesn't operate itself. So, you need people to maintain it. You need people to train other people how to use it. And then there's also evergreening. And, of course, that computer that you bought today, suddenly, 2 days from now, it's half the price and twice as fast. So that becomes an issue for us. Here in the school, we invest about 4.5% of our total budget into information technology and the support thereof. So it's a pretty significant commitment, and it's it's ongoing fixed costs for us. It's 4.5% of our budget, forever basically, if not more.
When you look at the cost of innovation in order to keep on top of this just for yourselves, you must also have to look at it from the point of view of being able to attract students here.
Yes, it's an investment, and we use the technology not just to attract students but also to attract faculty. Maintaining this kind of environment is a very expensive proposition, but the payoff for us is the good people that come to our school. We invest a lot of technology not just to support instruction, but to also support research. And for many young up-and-coming academics, the prospect of a lot of technological support when they're doing their research can be more attractive than a few extra dollars in their pockets. And sometimes, here we feel like a small market hockey team a little bit. I mean, there are much larger schools with deeper pockets than us in the U.S., and so we need to be a little bit innovative to attract people to our school. But we've done a very good job of that, as evidenced by the quality of people we have here. For our students, it's also very attractive. I mentioned how instructors use this technology to teach, but our students also use the technology to do their presentations as well. I've always said that technology is already a de facto requirement for our students. You cannot do a Bachelor of Commerce degree today without a lot of access to computers. And so we've got smart classrooms, we've got large computing labs, we've got laptop connectivity stations so students can bring in their own laptops and be connected. And the idea is that we want to teach our students that technology is a tool. It's not an end unto itself. Ideally, we want to teach our students to learn how to learn, because what you understand about technology today is most likely going to be irrelevant 6 months from now. And so you always have to learn and adapt and change.
Well, this is exam time, and we were just down looking at the lab for the exam that was being prepared, and it was all locked up. Now, what are the special things that you have to do in order to prepare for an exam? Because for me, it's a big shock. When I went, you just went in there with your pen and you wrote.
Sure. Many of our exams are still written the traditional way with pencil and paper and optical scoring and multiple choice. But now we've got a new type of exam that is becoming more and more popular, and that's an exam that's written online. And a couple of our core courses in the first year now have big online testing components. And we have a scenario now where in some classes the student shows up in a computer lab. They've got maybe a very large database or a set of data to work with, and they have to solve problems and build models on computer rather than doing things on pencil and paper. So that's a tremendous undertaking because, of course, you know, in a core first-year section, you might have 500 students, and so we've got a number of these labs running simultaneously, and we have the exam that actually sits on a web server, and it's not released until a certain time, and then students submit their exams electronically, and there are penalties for being late, and it really does take a small army of people to deliver the exam. So again, in terms of complexity of doing that versus pen and paper, it's much more complex, but we think that we can test the students differently. We think we can test some of their higher level skills using technology. You know, again, with paper and pencil, you're just limited, and we're trying to be innovative and do some different things.
What do you do if you're in the middle of your exam and your computer crashes?
Well, that never happens, does it? There are things that happen occasionally, and one of the things we also teach our students, of course, is that it's important to back up your work, and as you go along, you need to be saving things and that sort of thing. And I mean, that's just a good practice, and that's something we try and instill. But if there is an absolute disaster, then we have to make amends. And like I said, there are a whole team of people who are in radio communication with each other, and when one of these unfortunate events occurs, we have ways to deal with it.
How do you get around cheating?
Well, that's always a problem, even with pencil and paper. But when your exam is online, now there are a whole bunch of suddenly brand new avenues that are potentially available for students. And so, again, we try and use some technology to monitor what's going on and monitor what people are accessing and making sure that they're not sending instant messages to each other over the internet and that sort of thing. But, the same challenges are there, definitely.
I noticed everything was locked up.
Yeah, the computers were all rebuilt and prepared for the exam, and then the doors were locked, and so that we know that when the students walk in, everybody is sitting down at a terminal that's built the same way. There aren't any unfair advantages that somebody would get.
How are you incorporating some of this new technology into the courses that you're teaching?
The recent revolution in communications that has largely been brought about by the internet affects just about everybody, and that's the point I was trying to make in my course. It was a course on business strategy in the internet, and the idea was that for a few years, students had been learning in the business school all about e-commerce and technology and business planning, and I wanted to give them a chance to actually apply some of this knowledge to real-world situations. So I arranged for 14 different organizations to come in and work with groups of my students, and the challenge for the students was to go out and solve real problems for real organizations at a strategy level in relation to e-commerce. And I had a real diverse group of organizations involved, and it surprised me a little bit at the beginning, but it was very interesting. And when you look at the spectrum, I had on one end a pastor of a small church in southern. On the southern side of the city, and he was trying to understand how, if at all, he could be using the intranet to communicate with his current congregation or maybe attract some new members and all that sort of stuff. And so I had a group of students deal with that particular problem. And one of the things they found is that they should be putting all of their sermons online for a number of reasons. It would give all of the congregation access to what was said on Sunday morning, but it would also save some money for the church because they no longer had to print these things out on paper and photocopy them and distribute them and all that sort of thing. So, on one hand, they were improving service to their constituents, but on the other hand, they were also saving some money at the same time, which was important because it was a very, very small church. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, we were dealing with ATCO Electric, and they were trying to understand if or how they could become a part of this communications revolution. Something is happening in the province right now called the Alberta SuperNet, and the idea is to link up 422 small communities with high-speed network access. And, of course, ATCO has got all kinds of assets and right-of-ways across the entire province with their power grid infrastructure there, and they were trying to figure out how they could be a part of this potentially. And so, you had everything from a small pastor all the way up to a very, very large publicly traded organization who were all trying to figure out what the internet and e-commerce meant to them.
How do you deal with the intergenerational sort of thing? When I consider my own experience, I started off in the media when we still had teletype and had to send things out with these funny little tapes that went out. And here I am now dealing with the digital recorders and trying to learn internet stuff. And yet the kids that are coming along, they just whiz away with stuff. I feel like I'm in this sandwich generation as far as computers go. How are you going to be able to deal with that as you have all these different people of different ages and skills moving through the education system?
Sure. It's interesting that you mention that. You know, I think of the students we have here today, and I think of the next generation of students that we're going to get, you know, students who are in grade 6 or grade 7 or grade 8 right now, and they have grown up not knowing what it's been like without the internet. And these young kids, you know, when they have a question, they're now used to having hundreds of answers at their disposal at the click of a mouse. And they're sort of, you know, you've heard the terms the Nintendo generation, and they're used to media and animation and television and you know, digital stereo and all that sort of stuff. And I think that they're going to have a very different set of expectations when they walk through our doors. And when you think to what education might have been like 10 or 20 years ago, you know, where you have a person standing at the front of the room talking at you for 2 or 3 hours straight, I think that the next generation of students might not be so receptive to that model. So, you know, we are changing, and we're changing quickly. And I think the changes happen largely through a lot of positive peer pressure. I mean, the students react very positively to innovative uses of technology, and once someone does it, the students expect that as the norm. And so once it happens in one course, when they move into a senior level course along the same strain, they expect the same type of instruction. So it starts with a few early adopters who get a lot of very positive reaction, and then I think it becomes sort of contagious from there.
Thank you very much, Brent.
Well, thank you.
That was Brent Pouquet, the Assistant Dean of Technology at the University of Alberta's School of Business. Coming up, the new age of ceramics. Just mention ceramics, and I immediately think of plates and knickknacks. That is, until I took a trip over to the Advanced Materials Lab at the Alberta Research Council. Here, ceramics are being developed for a whole variety of new applications, none of which involves handling objects delicately for fear they might break. In fact, today's ceramics are just the opposite. They're so rough and tough, they're the material of choice for many new inventions. And it's all up to technologist Lauren Johansson to test their limits.
Probably two of the main advantages of ceramics is its wear resistance and its thermal resistance. Generally, as you know, Alberta is quite heavily involved in the oil processing, oil development industry. So a lot of companies are trying to develop wear products that can be used in, say, oil tar sand extraction.
What are ceramics made from? What are the components?
Ceramics, that's quite a vast area. Some of the more elemental ceramics, I guess, would be alumina, or, say, zirconia, which is an oxide ceramic. Generally, ceramics, if you're looking at them, generally they're a non-metallic, brittle, high-temperature item. And some of the other areas, other types of ceramics that are non-oxide would be, say, a more exotic would be like a boron carbide or a silicon carbide.
What is it that the Research Council is doing with ceramics?
Right now we're quite a bit involved with solid oxide fuel cells, and also ceramic coatings would be two of our main focuses. The ceramic coatings has to do with, once again, the corrosion, erosion resistance associated maybe with the oil industry. And solid oxide fuel cells is always a popular item because of its fuel-efficient initiatives. I guess when you compare, like, say, a regular motor to a solid oxide fuel cell, the efficiency is probably double, at least double, for a solid fuel cell.
Now, why is that? What is it in ceramics that would make that happen?
I don't think it's really too much to do with the ceramic itself. It's just the chemistry involved. a solid oxide fuel cell operates at, say, between probably around 600 to 800 degrees Celsius. So a lot of conventional metallics will not work for that application. So you need something with a higher temperature resistance, such as a ceramic.
What are some of the other ceramic advanced materials you're working with?
Similar to the fuel cell, we're also working on separation membranes, which could be used in, say, a gas or liquid application. And once again, that also relates back to it's a corrosion resistance as well as temperature resistance. And depending on how you process the ceramic, you can do a really fine separation, like microparticles. You could separate from a fluid, or even molecular sieving, in the sense where you could separate different gas molecules from other gas molecules. Some of the other stuff we do, like I mentioned earlier, is the ceramic coating work, which is a ceramic with a metallic backing. Obviously, since metals rust a lot easier than, say, ceramics are plastics, you'd want to have like a barrier coating. But the only problem is sometimes with polymer coatings is you can't get the temperature or the abrasive resistance as far as you would from a ceramic coating. Some of the other things we're doing is with a group we own called Zymark, we're making ceramic substrates used in electrical applications, like a circuit board application. We're making something known as a multi-layer co-fired substrate.
Now, you've got something over here. It looks like this is used as armor. Can you tell me a little bit about this?
What we have in front of us is a ceramic chest plate. It's personnel armor. It's made out of alumina. And what they do is a company in Calgary known as CPC manufactures this. And the piece you're looking at is been tested with several bullet holes in it. And looking at the backside, it looks like it survived quite well. So what it is it's alumina, which is just one simple ceramic. And then it's encased in a Kevlar jacket to help retain any small particles of, say, flying ceramic or metallic from the bullet after it impacts the plate.
Now, what would give it its strength so that it doesn't shatter, that it actually stops the bullets from coming through?
One of the advantages to a ceramic is its fracture toughness. It's able to absorb the energy of impact from the bullet, and then the energy is then sort of dissipated through the ceramic as breakage. So what happens then is rather than the bullet going right through, due to its fracture toughness, it absorbs the energy and literally just breaks the bullet.
Well, this armor plating, it's awfully heavy. Why is that?
Well, the piece we're looking at is made from alumina, which is a fairly dense material, meaning density is related to, say, like grams per volume. So it just refers back to that it's fairly heavy. Like if you compare it to, say, some plastics, which have a density less than one, that means they float on water. Whereas alumina has a density of 4, which means it's 4 times denser than water for the same volume. So it is a heavier piece of material. I guess not only is it used for personnel, chest plates and such, but it's also used on armored vehicles, which would probably, it doesn't matter then because it's glued to a vehicle and you don't have to pack it around yourself. So,
now, what do you see as the future for ceramics?
I see the future of ceramics it depends on what application you're referring to. Obviously, there's a strong initiative for alternative energy, meaning the solid oxide fuel cell is a major player in that area. And I think what the Research Council is doing right now is we're trying to develop a micro solid oxide fuel cell, which would still provide a large energy output, but it would be a much smaller module.
How small?
Probably, we could probably get 10 times the wattage from, like, probably the same size. Or you could go get the same wattage for something that's, say, 10 times the size, 10 times less the size. So it depends on your what you need. If you need size or power output as a controlling factor.
When you're doing your work, what are some of the things that you do?
I work mainly in the ceramic processing area. I guess as a technologist, my job is maybe not as much the brainstorming, so to speak, but to provide feedback, meaning if you have an idea that you want to develop a product, I let you know that maybe this type of processing is required, or maybe the chemicals or the ceramics you thought would work well in this environment may not after all.
How do you deal with the testing and analysis when you're working on ceramic?
That's a good question. Depending on the application that the ceramic is going to be used for would sort of dictate the type of testing. Like getting back to the alumina armor plating, some of the major testing we did, which was hardness testing, which is a fracture toughness. What you do is you cut a piece of the alumina, polish it to a mirror finish, and with a diamond indenter, you hit it with a specified load at a specified time. What that does is it causes a fracture, like a crosshair, like an X. And just measuring the length of the fracture sort of dictates the strength, which is obviously important for an armor plating. Some of the other things we do here would be we can characterize membranes with our equipment, which is obviously not an armor plated application, but say for fuel cells, you can do pore size, surface area, permeability of gas or liquid, and also you can do density. Some of the other mechanical testings that you do would be bend strength or fracture toughness, and that is also just you just bend it and record the load that it breaks at. And some of the other simple stuff we can do would be surface roughness or abrasive, erosive testing.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I was speaking with Lorne Johansson. He's a chemical research technologist in the Advanced Materials Lab at the Alberta Research Council. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website. You can listen to past programs in real audio, and you can win prizes in our great contests. That's at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Paul Pates. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.